very much. Oh, good, everyone can hear me. So, 1 and 2 Samuel, in some ways they're really well known to us. In other ways, they're not so well known to us. Let me just explain what I mean by that. If you grew up in Sunday school, you've probably heard most of the best-known stories from 1 and 2 Samuel. We've all heard of little Samuel in the tent, late at night, when God calls him, and he goes to his boss Eli, thinking that Eli wants something. And he's told, no, I didn't call you, go back to bed. No, I didn't call you. Oh, not again, for heaven's sake, go back to bed. Until Eli finally realizes what's going on. Everybody has heard the story of David and Goliath. I think most people who didn't grow up in Sunday school even have heard of David and Bathsheba. And we've all heard of David rejoicing as he brings the ark into Jerusalem and dancing before the Lord with all his might. But usually, that's all we remember and that's all we look at. So keep your Bibles open, because I will be going through Samuel, but there will only be a few verses which I'll read. Now, some of those are a little long, but they're worth quoting at length because they're the main points I'm trying to make in the book. On the one hand, it's a history of King David, King Saul, Samuel, and Israel. On the other hand, it's actually trying to make a point. And when you try reading it as a history, you soon start saying, hang on a minute, how does this all fit together? Well, what's going on? This doesn't make sense. Half a chapter ago, Jonathan routed the Philistines, and now they're losing again, and now Jonathan's routing them again. What's happening? So you can read it as a history, but also as a point that's trying to be made. And I've cut this down into several sections. So, 1 Samuel chapters 1 to 5. This is the birth of Samuel and God speaking to Samuel and what happens to the Ark of the Covenant. The main point to pick up here is that God sets Samuel apart in the same way that he sets apart people like Samson, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And he sets Samuel apart by having him born to a woman who doesn't have any children yet, and that's Hannah. And like all these characters, when they have no children, they're crying out to God for children, suddenly God gives them a child. The only difference is this time Hannah decides she will dedicate Samuel to God. And I'm going to read part of Hannah's prayer because this is a point that will come up again and again in 2 Samuel. And 1 and 2 Samuel, sorry. So this is Hannah's prayer. Starting at verse 7. I'm only reading part of it or we'll be here all evening. The Lord sends poverty and wealth. He humbles and he exalts. He raises the poor from the dust and lifts the needy from the ash heap. He seats them with princes and has them inherit a throne of honor. For the foundations of the earth are the Lord's. Upon them he has set the world. He will guard the feet of his saints, and the wicked will be silenced in darkness. It is not by strength that one prevails. Those who oppose the Lord will be shattered. He will thunder against him from heaven. The Lord will judge the ends of the earth. He will give strength to his king and exalt the horns of his anointed. Now, it's obvious that Hannah doesn't know about a king, doesn't know about any of this. So some say, what's this prayer about? Well, it's probably not actually a prayer she originally prayed. This is the author trying to make a point. And this point's come up again and again. God lifts up the poor. God lifts up the humble. God lifts up the needy. If you trust in God, whom should you fear? If you oppose God, well, you're in trouble. That's what happens. David says a similar prayer at the end of 2 Samuel. So, let's go into the story. This starts exactly where the book of Judges left off. The people of Israel are living in Israel and they're doing a very bad job of following God. They're still worshipping gods they should not worship. Eli the priest has sons who are disobedient, who are difficult, who will not listen, and who he simply cannot control. So the first four chapters are there to make a clear difference between Samuel and Eli. And in those four chapters, the people of Israel manage to lose the Ark of the Covenant, the box with God's laws in it, to the Philistines. Why? Because when they were losing a battle, instead of saying to God, "Why have we lost?" they sent for the Ark, carried it out in front of them and said, "We've got the Ark, how can we possibly lose?" And the Philistines were going, "Oh no, it's the Ark of the Covenant, we can fight better!" And the Philistines won. But the Philistines can't keep the Ark of the Covenant. They have to send it back. In 1 Samuel chapter 5, there are some really funny stories about what happens to the Philistines when they try to keep the Ark. But the irony of the story is the Philistines understand it better than the Israelites. They send it back with gifts. The Israelites decide it might be fun to have a little peep inside the Ark to see what they can find. Result? Disaster. Several of them are killed. So clearly this isn't hanging together. Samuel becomes the judge of Israel for two chapters, 6 to 7. He saves the people of Israel. In many ways, Samuel, the last judge, is like a king, although he isn't one. But when Samuel puts his own sons in charge, you get a complete repeat of Eli and his sons. Samuel's sons are corrupt. So the people go to Samuel and say, "Look, Samuel, you're too old to be our ruler anymore, and your sons are rubbish. We can't stand them. Give us a king." This is their solution. We need a king. Now, this is a very key point here. What God says when Samuel goes to God and says that they want a king. This is 1 Samuel chapter 8. Samuel prays to God and it says, "And the Lord said to him, 'Listen to all that the people are saying to you. As it is not you they have rejected, they have rejected me as their king. As they have done from the day I brought them up out of Egypt until this day, forsaking me and serving other gods, so they are doing to you. Now listen to them, but warn them solemnly and let them know what the king who reigns over them will do.'" And there follows a very long, almost anti-monarchist piece from Samuel saying, "You don't want a king. He'll take your sons to fight in dangerous wars. He'll take your daughters to be his mistresses, his cooks and his perfumers and his bakers. He'll take your fields. He'll take your land. He'll take everything he wants and he'll keep it for himself." But the people, verse 15, refused to listen to Samuel. "No," they said. "No," they said. "We want a king over us. Then we will be like all the other nations, with a king to lead us and who will go out before us and fight our battles." When Samuel heard what the people had said, he repeated it before the Lord. The Lord answered them, "Listen to them and give them a king." In other words, the people of Israel don't want to be God's chosen people anymore. That is what they are saying. And you would expect the response from God to be, "Fine, if you don't want to be my people anymore, that's it. I'm done with you. I'll find some other group of people who will understand me better and will respect me more and be more flipping grateful." But the Lord says, "Okay, you want a king? You've got one." And the king they get is King Saul. One Samuel chapter 9 all the way to chapter 12. He seems to be everything a king should be. He's good looking. He's great. He's well respected. He saves the people of Israel from the Ammonites. But by Samuel chapter 13, he has disobeyed God. He's made a burnt offering to God, which wasn't his job. His son has to save Israel because Saul can't. And by chapter 15, he's gone to kill the Amalekites. He's plundered them when he was told not to, and he's rejected. Now, when you're reading this, this is really important. Don't get bogged down with, why did God tell Saul to kill the Amalekites? The point was, in that time, that was what would happen when you went to war. The issue is, they're supposed to go to war to get something. That's why you go to war. But this time, they've gone to war to get nothing. The key verse of what happens now is 1 Samuel chapter 13, starting at verse 13, when he's made a burnt offering he shouldn't have done. You have acted foolishly, Samuel says. You have not kept the commandments the Lord gave you. If you had, he would have established your kingdom over Israel for all time. But now your kingdom will not endure. The Lord has sought out a man after his own heart and appointed him leader of his people, because you have not kept the Lord's command. Now we know a good king came, and his name was Jesus. God uses our mistakes to bring about incredible good. But there are still mistakes, and there are still consequences. God never wanted the people to have a king. But now they've demanded one, and they've had Saul, who, as the book goes on, goes madder and madder, more and more paranoid. He finds another one, King David. What does a man after God's own heart mean? Actually, it means a man God has set his heart on, a man God has chosen. Our mistake with this is to assume that David was such a wonderful person. That must have been why God chose him. And we spend a lot of time trying to work out exactly what makes David this wonderful person. Actually, in many ways, he is a very wonderful person. He's good looking. He's been outside. He's a shepherd. And he's being called to be the shepherd of Israel. But God's actually chosen David, well, because he's chosen him. That's why it's an act of grace, not an act of works. And it's hinting, and I choose that word carefully, it's hinting at a comment made in Genesis that one day Judah would rule the people of God. Now we know that because we know the rest of the story. They probably didn't know that. So let's have a look at David. We first meet him in the 16th chapter of Samuel, when Samuel anoints him as king over Israel in a very similar way to the way that he anointed Saul. Go back and have a look at Samuel chapter 8 to 12 and read the story. Then read the story of David's anointing. By the middle of the chapter, David is Saul's harpist because Saul has received an evil spirit from God. Actually, I don't think that means he's demon-possessed. I think it means Saul, like all dictators, is bad-tempered and paranoid. And David plays music in order to calm him down. It's a little bit like in some films, you see, where the dictator's going crazy and they've got a doctor or they've got a psychologist who has to try to calm him down or give him pills to try to stop him going completely barmy. The Last King of Scotland is an excellent example, although the book's better than the film. But, well, that's a matter of opinion, and let's not get sidetracked. In 17, we get the story of David and Goliath, where David is shown as the one person who hears what God is saying. The only thing to say about that is Goliath should have realized that when he's being attacked by a slinger, he had a big problem. If a slinger's coming for you and all you've got is a sword and shield, you get your shield up as quickly as you can, and hope that he runs out of stones and then you can kill him. Goliath was probably so affronted that he was dealing with someone who didn't even have a sword. He didn't even think about it. But that doesn't belittle what David managed to do. So by chapter 18, he seems to have everything. The people think he's wonderful. Jonathan is his ally. Michal, Saul's daughter, is his wife. All Saul's attempts to kill him don't seem to be working. And you'd have thought if he becomes king tomorrow, everyone would throw the most colossal party ever. Well, almost everyone, but who cares about King Saul? But for the rest of the book, King Saul is after David. 1 minute, he was Saul's greatest general. The next, he's a bandit and an outlaw, fleeing from place to place with Saul's army after him. This is the time where David is meant to have written most of his psalms that cry out to God. He's fleeing from his country. He's fleeing from his people. The person who he is most loyal to is trying to cut off his head. Now, obviously, at some point, David heard about this vision for him to be king. And you would wonder if he'd even given up on it. In 24 and 26 chapters, Samuel 24, Samuel 26, you can read the full story. David has two opportunities to kill Saul, but he doesn't. Instead, he flees to join the Philistines. They are great stories, by the way. The Bible's very fond of little bits of humour, and there's something very amusing about Saul in a cave having a wee while David sneaks up on him and cuts his robe off. That would make a very funny scene in films. It's so funny that most people say Saul was asleep instead. They don't really want to admit that David could have killed him while he was answering a call of nature. But by Samuel 28, David has fled to the Philistines. He's so desperate that he's in the land of Gath, where Goliath came from, fighting for their king as a raider. And to raid, he has to attack other tribes, leave no survivors, and pretend that he's fighting the people of Israel. You do wonder what he would have done if he'd actually gone to fight Saul, but luckily the Philistines sent him packing. And while Saul's fighting his final battle, David is fighting the Amalekites. So just as a footnote, it's quite clear that although it says in the Bible Saul killed them all, he obviously didn't. And when David is fighting them, a lot of them get away on camels. So you need to take comments of they all died, they were all destroyed, with a pinch of salt. That's the way people wrote then. In chapter 29 to 31, sorry everybody, my counting's gone funny, Saul consults a witch to be told what he probably should have worked out ages ago. God is not answering his prayers because he's rejected him. By this time, Saul is a terrified, paranoid, weak, scared man who has killed several of his own priests because he decided they were plotting with David. He has the worst obituary you could have. It all began so well and ended with Saul killing himself. You could say that every dictator you read about will remind you in some way of our friend Saul. So let's move on to 2 Samuel now. If you want more details, just read the story, and you can even come back and tell me I've got it all wrong. David mourns the death of Saul. This is one of the things that really draws us to David, I think. The fact that when he hears that Saul is dead, instead of being pleased, as most people would expect, he has a good cry and writes a song which mourns Saul. It's so generous. You want to know what grace looks like? Look at how David responds to that. They were faster than eagles, stronger than lions. How the mighty have fallen. You'd understand why he said that about Jonathan, but Saul? He even kills the person who brought the message because the guy stupidly said, oh, I killed Saul, thinking David was going to reward him, instead of which he got himself killed. In the first six chapters, we see David's rise, just like we saw Saul's rise. He's made king in Hebron. That's a city which is now in Israel's West Bank. You can look it up if you want to, in the Palestinian territories, if you want to be political. He's made king in Hebron. He defeats Ish-bosheth, the son of Saul, who still wants to be king. The only footnote here is again David's grace, because when David's army commander kills Abner, Saul's commander, David is so upset, he curses Joab for doing it. Joab is clearly one of those people who decides that sometimes the boss doesn't know what's good for him and goes out and does things on his own authority. When Ish-bosheth, King Saul's son, is killed, in a repeat of what happened earlier, David kills his killers, saying they killed an innocent man, and then came bringing the message to him, clearly thinking they were bringing good news. Jerusalem. David takes Jerusalem, a very shrewd political move, which ensures Israel has a capital nobody will fight over and no tribes feel slighted. Caleb had it once, but since then, it's never been ruled by anyone. And after a shaky start, you have this wonderful scene where he brings the ark into Jerusalem, clearly deciding he needs a religious capital. And he dances before the Lord. What a wonderful scene. But by chapter 7, David's decided he'd rather put God in a box. He wants God in a temple. Because that way, let's face it, Jerusalem will always be the religious capital of the country. And this is God's reply. Go tell my servant David, this is what the Lord says. Are you the one who built me a house to dwell in? I have not dwelt in a house from the day I brought the Israelites up out of Egypt to this day. I have been moving from place to place with a tent as my dwelling. Wherever I have moved with all the Israelites, did I ever say to any of those rulers who I commanded to shepherd my people Israel, why have you not built me a house of cedar? Now then, tell my servant David, this is what the Lord Almighty says. I took you from the pasture and from following the flock to be ruler over all my people Israel. I have been with you wherever you have gone, and I have cut off all your enemies from before you. Now I will make your name great, but the names of the greatest men of the earth. And I will provide a place for my people Israel, and will plant them so that they will have a home for their own, and no longer be disturbed. Wicked people will not oppress them any more, as they did at the beginning. And I have done ever since the time I appointed leaders over my people Israel. I will also give you rest from all your enemies. The Lord declares this. The Lord himself will establish a house for you. When your days are over and you rest with your fathers, I will raise up your offspring to succeed you, who will come from your own body, and I will establish his kingdom. He is the one who will build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne over his kingdom forever. I will be his father, and he will be my son. When he does wrong, I will punish him with the rod of men, the floggings inflicted by men, but my love will never be taken away from him, as I took it away from Saul, whom I removed from before you. Your house and your kingdom will endure forever before me. Your throne will be established forever. This is a hint, everyone. A hint that one day there will be a king who will rule on the throne forever, who will be descended from David. Again, we know the rest of that story. We know what that means, and it's always good to remember that. But it's also worth remembering, what would the people think when they read this? They'd think he meant that at some point there would be a great king ruling Israel. This was meant to be one book, not two. And it was probably written at the time of the exile, when these records were all put together, telling people that God does not give up on the house of David. No wonder David's response is worship. Now, I know time's getting on, so I will say this next. Why couldn't the story end there? Well, one reason it can't end there is because if it does, we will be left believing this solution of giving the people a king may not have been such a bad idea. Okay, God didn't want it. Okay, Saul was a pretty horrible king. But David's a wonderful king. He's not put a foot wrong. He's even gracious to his enemies. He's just like God. So this king idea was a brilliant idea. If we start believing that, it's not a far jump to start believing that if you can just get it right, you have nothing to worry about, and that David is someone who got it right. But as David's human, and everyone is corruptible, it's downhill from here. 2 Samuel 8:11, we see David's military exploits. What you will notice is David becomes quite ruthlessly cruel to his enemies. Admittedly, this is a time when that was the way things were. And in battle, you did have to be a lot crueler than we should be. And a lot crueler than, thank goodness, is recognized now as being reasonable. But you do notice that David's behavior is becoming more like a tyrant than like a good and just and faithful king. And by chapter 11, you get the story of David and Bathsheba. Just a couple of things I'll say about Bathsheba before we move on. A lot of ink has been spilt, and a lot of arguments have been made about whose fault this was. Was Bathsheba deliberately giving him the come on? Was it just David's fault for seeing a beautiful woman and behaving like a man? Was he just in the wrong place at the wrong time? Well, it's actually not a good idea to try to reason this out. The problem with David's story is there's so little information in there about who thought what and how things went. We try to fill in the gaps. We try to explain why Bathsheba was being deliberately provocative, if that's what we think. We try to say why she wasn't, if we're sorry for her. We try to say that it wasn't David's fault, if we're sorry for him. If we're annoyed with him, it's all his flipping fault. All that really shows you is what your own prejudices are, what your own viewpoint is, and how you try to make the Bible fit that. We all do it, but it's worth being aware when you read the story that that is what you're doing. And when you're pretty sure that's what you are doing, try to go back and look at some of the facts. I'll just give you two now. Most women in Israel would bathe after their period. That's what you did. That's what you were commanded to do. And you do it in your courtyard or on the roof. I've seen both options offered as a translation, including the same thing both on the same page. That's what you did, though. So she may not have been being deliberately provocative. By the same token, when the king asks for you, you don't have a lot of choice. You do what you're told. Because if you don't, he can kill you. Or he can force you. Maybe he did do that. We don't know, because we're not told. But anyway, we know exactly what happens next. And I just want to read to you God's response to David now, because this is also important, and it's a complete contrast to what we heard before. I anointed you king over Israel, and I delivered you from the hand of Saul. I gave your master's house to you and your master's wives into your arms. I gave you the house of Israel and Judah, and if all that had been too little, I would have given you even more. Why did you despise the word of the Lord by doing what is evil in his sight? You struck down Uriah the Hittite with the sword, and you took his wife to be your own. You killed him with the sword of the Ammonites. Now, therefore, the sword will never depart from your house, because you despised me and took the wife of Uriah the Hittite to be your own. This is what the Lord says. Out of your own household, I am going to bring calamity upon you. Before your very eyes, I will take your wives and give them to one who is close to you, and he will lie with your wives in broad daylight. You did it in secret. I will do this thing in broad daylight before all Israel. Then David said to Nathan, I have sinned against the Lord. Nathan replied, the Lord has taken away your sin. You are not going to die. But because by doing this you have made the enemies of the Lord show utter contempt, the son born to you will die. It's a sad story in which everybody loses out. And this shows that when you make mistakes, even if you're forgiven, there are disastrous consequences for everybody. Even if you're forgiven. Because though the Lord may take away your sin, he won't take away the consequences. The only thing I will also say about this is people have been very upset about the death of the child, and it is upsetting. People have been very upset about David's sort of cavalier attitude. He fasts and he weeps and he prays and he lies on the floor while the child is dying. And when the child dies, it's as though nothing's happened. And he goes back to what he was doing. He eats, he worships in the house of the Lord, and he comforts his wife. And people can't understand why. It's odd behavior, but before we judge him too harshly and say how utterly uncaring and selfish that shows he is, please remember that we're looking at a time that was over 3,000 years ago. In that time, children died. To us, the death of a child is devastating because it rarely happens. To them, the death of a child was also devastating, but it happened all the time. In many places, it still does. But the damage has been done. Chapters 13 to 15, we see David's sons and all the terrible disaster that results in. Just like Eli and his sons and Samuel and his sons, it seems David has absolutely no control over them. And if they learn anything from him, it was all the wrong things. One daughter raped, one son murdered, and by the end of the story, one son has rebelled, chased David out of Jerusalem, and he weeps as he crosses the Kidron Valley. Many years later, there was another king who also crossed the Kidron Valley on the way out of Jerusalem to a place called Golgotha. After chapter 16, from chapter 16 to 18, it's even worse. Absalom does exactly what the Lord had said would happen. He takes David's wives and he sleeps with them in public for everyone to see. But Absalom is defeated, although David is heartbroken because Absalom is dead. I've heard people complaining that David didn't love anybody. I've heard commentators say David didn't understand relationships. But he obviously understood something. If even though Absalom was such a terrible man that did so many awful things, David can weep bitterly when he hears Absalom has been murdered. This time, his own general, Joab, who murdered David against his orders, has to tell him to snap out of it. I think David resented that, because in the next chapter he has replaced Joab with someone else. Amamasa is now head of the army. But David returns to Jerusalem, but it's never quite the same. The people of Israel are no longer united. They're forming tribes again, Judah versus Israel. And a member of the house of Benjamin rebels against David. Joab defeats him, and at the same time, he kills his rival, Amamas, so he's back in charge of the army. This is such a human story. The Bible is a human book with human stories. You have people jostling for power. You have people arguing. You have people committing murder, including around people like King David. Right, now time is really getting on, so we'll just look at the last three chapters very quickly. They're basically footnotes of David's reign. One psalm, one story about a famine, and I'm going to skip to chapter 24 very briefly. There's a really strange story that finishes it about when David took a census of the people. Apparently because God was angry with them for some reason. We're not told exactly why. But David uses the threshing floor of a Jebusite to make an offering, which stops the killing, and that is where the temple was built. Those who have been really concentrating will also remember I haven't mentioned Solomon. He's not mentioned here, but we know Solomon goes on to be the next king of Israel. God uses our worst mistake to bring about his glory. And right at the end, we have an oracle of David, son of Jesse. The last words of David, exalted by the Most High, the man anointed by the God of Jacob, Israel's singer of songs. These are his last words. The Spirit of the Lord spoke through me. His word was on my tongue. The Lord of Israel spoke. The Rock of Israel said to me, when one rules over men in righteousness, when he rules in the fear of God, he is like the light of morning at sunrise, on a cloudless morning, like the brightness before rain, like the brightness after rain that brings the grass from the earth. Is not my house right with God? Has he not made for me an everlasting covenant, arranged and secured in every part? Will he not bring to fruition my salvation and grant me my every desire? But evil men are all to be cast aside like thorns, which are not gathered with the hand. Whoever touches thorns uses a tool of iron or the shaft of a spear. Essentially, this is rather like the prayer Hannah prayed right at the beginning, where she said, the Lord cast down the proud and lifted the humble, the poor, the needy. And what happened to the enemies of the Lord? As far as David is concerned, his salvation is secure and his house is secure, because the Lord had promised to reign over Israel and for his family to reign over Israel forever and ever. We know David had no idea what that would result in. We know the one who would rule forever and ever was Jesus. But as we finish this story, what can we learn? It's a story about leadership. Not just leadership in the church, but people who are supposed to lead countries or companies. People who look at David and see what he got wrong, what he got right. God uses our flawed decisions to bring about his plan, whatever we may say. I've heard some say God had David planned all along. The only mistake was the people asked for a king too early. Well, that's one of the if-onlys you always get in history. But the point is, that's not what happened. The people didn't really want God. They wanted to be like all the other nations, and God let them have what they wanted. The result's been disastrous. David has unified Israel. Morally, he's been an absolute and complete failure. This seems to be a problem with people in the church now, with leaders now, and it seems to be, if we look at the Bible closely, a problem right through the Bible as well. This seemed to be a solution to the problem. Every man did what was right in his own eyes, because there was no king. But now they've got a king, and the king does what is right in his own eyes a lot of the time. The main point about David's failings is he did exactly what God had warned the people of Israel every king would do. If he wanted something, he took it, because as king, he could have it. The question remains, has David's son Solomon learnt from his father's mistakes? Will he bring about the reign of Israel forever and ever? Will God keep his covenant, as he's promised he will, and always love the house of David? But Solomon, as they say, is another story. Thank you very much.
Thanks, David. If you want to move slightly to the right, then we're kind of both in shot. I have a few notes, which have got kind of cut up a bit as David has covered various bits and pieces. I think one of the key points that you've brought out, David, is that what a lot of these two books of Samuel are about are that God opposes the proud and lifts up the humble.
Mm.
We have character studies in David and Saul. We have Saul, who's in the end dishonest, lacks integrity, and we see pride coming in, don't we? And yet God opposes this. Saul doesn't acknowledge his mistakes, but we see that David does. We find that David trusts God in all circumstances. I do wonder how he managed to still trust God's promises when he was running from Saul for so long. And something you didn't actually cover, David. David didn't immediately walk into kingship of the whole of Israel when Saul died, did he?
No, I was worried about what would happen if I started dwelling on that and we had another mini-sermon being built. Yes, it sounds like, when you look at the book, that it happened immediately, and I've done that because this is an overview. But yes, there's a war between the house of Saul and the house of David that goes on for several years. And if you read the story, it's actually quite a painful read.
Because at the beginning, obviously, when Samuel is born, we're still kind of in the time of the judges.
Yes.
And everyone is still very tribal. And a lot of us will know that later on in the story of Israel, it divides into two halves, or unequal halves, you could say. But even before then, you still had this separation of the two southern kingdoms tending to be different and very separate from the 10 northern kingdoms. And they were all being very tribal.
Yeah.
And when you covered judges, you could see that you had judges who tended not to... We maybe think that they covered all of Israel, but they didn't. They often worked just in one of the tribal areas.
Yeah, this is the problem of deciding which bits you leave out and which bits you're going to include when you've only got a limited time frame to do it. But yes, we have a very tribal society where actually, even after Absalom's rebellion, it comes out again very strongly because a Benjamite called Sheba decides he's going to rebel and starts causing trouble. And all of Israel desert David, apart from Judah, and go sneaking off back home again. They can't let go of this tribal society. And I think very often we just forget about that because we're used to the idea of Israel just being, well, Israel.
And Judah does normally include Benjamin, doesn't it?
Not in this case, actually, okay. Because the person who rebelled was a Benjamite. But yes, after we finish 1 and 2 Samuel, Judah is more or less aligned with Benjamin. But at the time of David, it's often the Benjamites who start causing trouble, obviously because they resented not being rulers of Israel anymore.
Okay. That's covered most of those bits. It occurred to me while David was speaking that David is very much the first character in the Old Testament, it seems to me, who, as a human being, really shows grace, because he shows grace to Saul by not killing him when he could, and he shows grace to Absalom, because despite of what he did, his command was that Absalom shouldn't be killed, and obviously he grieved so much when he was. So that's something that struck me, while you were talking about that.
Yeah, it's... I was actually quite nettled that John Goldingday, when he wrote his commentaries on the Old Testament for Everyone, almost pushes that under the carpet and just keeps on talking about how David doesn't understand people, didn't love people, didn't care about people. And you're thinking, hang on. The way he behaves when Absalom dies, the way he behaves when Saul dies as well, as you said, Dad, it's what draws us to him, isn't it, as a human? The fact that David is prepared to cry over people who really don't deserve his sympathy. And that is how grace is supposed to work.
Yeah. Okay. I think that's covered most of the little bits that I wanted to pick out. Yep, it does. Right, at the moment on Facebook, we don't have any questions. How about in the room?